In the matter of State versus RBL, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Margaret McLean, Assistant Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of Mr. RBL.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Mark Manahack from Ashmanstein Walder Hayden, on behalf of the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Dominic Carroll, Fox Rothschild, on behalf of Amicus, the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. William Kyle Meegan, Supervising Assistant Prosecutor, on behalf of the state.
Good morning, Your Honors. Deputy Attorney General Stephen Cattanaro, on behalf of the Attorney General, Amicus Curiae.
Good afternoon, counsel, and welcome. Justice Solomon is participating. He's watching the argument in this case. Ms. McLean, please go ahead.
Your Honors, may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if it's necessary.
That's fine.
And during the argument, I'd like to start with and focus primarily on the invalid Miranda waiver. I'll rely on my briefs for the other two issues, though if there's time, I'd like to briefly touch on the incomplete Hampton charge in this case. I'm happy to answer the court's questions on any issue in any order.
Please go ahead.
So turning to the Miranda issue, when police interrogate a defendant, they must ensure that the defendant fully understands his rights and that he knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily gives up those rights. They can't trick him into giving up his rights by misleading him about his status or about the scope of the interrogation. They cannot burden the exercise of his rights, and they can't avoid explaining the true meaning of those rights if a defendant asks questions. In this case, the police did all of these things. Under the totality of the circumstances, the misstatements from police combined with RBL's lack of experience with the criminal justice system and his difficulty understanding English, the state failed to meet its high burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that RBL knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived his rights. So there's a couple of types of problems here, and I'll go through those in order, but all of these kind of more specific problems do have to be considered in their totality and in the context of an interrogation being conducted by someone who says he sometimes has difficulty understanding English, on whom the burden has been placed by detectives to ask clarifying questions, someone who doesn't have familiarity with the criminal justice system. So turning first to the kind of deception aspect of this case, as this court said in Nyhammer and reaffirmed in Sims, police don't have an affirmative obligation to volunteer that a defendant is a suspect. However, this court repeatedly reaffirmed that what police say about a defendant's suspect status and what the defendant knows about his suspect status are relevant in a totality of the circumstances analysis. And in this case, before informing RBL of his rights, the police affirmatively misled him about the jeopardy he was in. They knew they were investigating serious criminal allegations of child sexual assault. They had already taken statements from the complainant and her mother. But rather than truthfully tell RBL why they wanted to interrogate him, they lied. They told him they wanted to talk to him about the dispute over who owned the tools in his van, the dispute between him and his ex-wife. And they characterized this as a civil matter.
So does your position on that issue depend on the factual assertion that they told defendant that they sought to question him only about the tools, or that defendant Rodriguez informed defendant that they sought to question him only about a civil matter?
I don't think that it matters that they said only those things, particularly in the totality of the circumstances analysis. However, it is both of those things is, or what they told him and how they characterized it is a relevant factor. And it was the only specifics Detective Rodriguez got into during this conversation in the driveway was about the tools, and that's false. He knew he wanted to talk about the allegations of criminal conduct, and he instead specifically hid that fact and instead mentioned only the tools. And it was Detective Rodriguez who was the person to characterize that investigation into the tools dispute as a civil one as opposed to a criminal one. And this is at 4T page 203. defense counsel was trying to tease out exactly what Detective Rodriguez had said or not to RBL and said, so you talked about the items he was trying to get back? Response, briefly, yes. The ex had related that she was disputing his ownership of those. So it essentially became a civil matter at that point.
There's nothing in indicating that that it was ever characterized to RBL as a civil matter. Was there? That's, he was characterizing tool theft, tool misappropriation, or tool dispute, rather a dispute over ownership, to be, that would be a civil matter.
So the next line is, question, it became a civil matter at that point, and that's what you basically told him? Correct. So I would maintain on this record, the detective did communicate to RBL that it was a civil matter, but even insofar as the record is ambiguous, I don't think it is, but even if this record is ambiguous, it's plain from the detective's testimony that he was intentionally concealing the true reason he wanted to speak to RBL.
Before that, didn't the detective say, I stated that I was there to get him to come back to the police station and talk to him about a few things that had gone on? A few things sounds like more than just one thing about the tools.
Yes. However, then we get into, did you tell him what you were going to talk about? No, I didn't get into it. And then he volunteers this clarification of, but didn't you say you were going to talk about the tools? And that's where he then brings up the civil matter. So, again, I think
he brought up the civil matter, characterizing it in the conversation with the attorney, at least as I would read that, as a civil matter. Previously having described what actually was said to him without using that term.
Again, I think
this, a good cross-examiner immediately says, so it had a nice leading question and got an answer that certainly was a good answer. But there's nothing indicating he actually used civil matter in his discussion.
I think his response, that's basically when he agrees with the defense counsel's question, that's basically what you told him, that it was a civil matter. He says, yes. I think that is enough. But again, even if this court finds he didn't use the word civil, the only specific thing he said he wanted to talk to RBL about was who owned the tools in the van. And the entire tenor of this conversation is that this is a non-serious, non-criminal matter that RBL shouldn't be worried about. Just come down, we're going to sort out who owns these tools in your van, and let's go to the police station to do it.
We know that that was completely false because the officers had no intention of talking to him about the tools, didn't talk to him about the tools whatsoever. So your argument is he made a false representation, a lie to the defendant in order to get him to come down to the police station and have this discussion.
Yes, he lied. He knew he didn't want to talk about tools, and that's what he told RBL they wanted to talk about.
When the district court holds an evidentiary hearing on the Miranda question, do we have to defer to the district court's factual findings if there's substantial evidence to support them?
The standard of review for factual findings is whether it was clearly erroneous. So yes, there is some level of deference. However, as this court reaffirmed in LH, appellate courts must conduct a searching and critical of review of the record to ensure protection of a defendant's constitutional rights.
Assume for a moment that it would be wrongful to mislead the defendant by saying, we want to have you come down and talk about tools, period. Let's just dissect that premise for the moment, which I'm sure you like. But does it change the analysis for the police to routinely perhaps add after that, and some other things? Does that then sanitize the wrong, if you will, by leaving it open-ended? There might be some other things. Does that fix the problem?
No, it does not fix the problem, generally speaking, and particularly in this case, it did not fix the problem, given the totality of the circumstances with this Miranda waiver. But if police essentially, as your question posits, essentially routinely lie about why they want to talk to defendants and try to cover up by saying, and some other things maybe, that is They shouldn't lie. They shouldn't volunteer information that is false. They shouldn't use those lies to get people to come to the police station to waive their fundamental constitutional rights. And that factor should weigh heavily in a totality of the circumstances analysis as to the validity of a defendant's waiver of his constitutional rights.
And that's the argument that you're advancing. Look at the totality of the circumstances, weigh this factor heavily. You're not asking for a bright line rule as amici are?
No, I'm not asking for a bright line rule. I'm saying that the lie is a factor that must be considered. As this court said in Nyhammer, as this court said in Sims, it's a factor to consider. It weighs heavily against the validity of the waiver here, but it's also, it must be viewed in combination with the fact that this interrogation is being conducted in English. They didn't offer RBL a Spanish language interpreter. They didn't offer to do the Miranda colloquy in Spanish. They put the burden on him to ask questions. And when he asked those questions, they did not answer them appropriately. So, for example, with respect to his right to silence, RBL expresses confusion. He does not understand what the warning, anything you say can be used against you in a court of law. He asks, court of law? The detectives don't clarify their prior misunderstanding. They don't even reread the entirety of the right. They don't say your statements will be used against you. And they certainly don't specify that it's a criminal court, that now we're talking about these serious criminal allegations.
They did complete the Miranda warnings, though. They did say that his statements could be used against him, did they not?
They said that, and then he asked questions, and their follow-up responses were inadequate. They followed up by saying court of law means in court, without specifying what kind of court we're in, without specifying that it's a criminal court. They didn't reemphasize that his statements will be used against him to his detriment. They said, we're going to talk about things that are important and things that are on the record. And neither one of these clarifications gets at what the core of this warning, which is be careful when you say things, because what you say will be used against you in criminal investigations, certainly, and if you go to trial, a criminal trial. They did not explain this to RBL, and he had no way of understanding, of divining this information from the detective's clarification.
The detective also says before the waiver is fully signed, I don't think you have anything to hide. How does that factor into the analysis?
That impermissibly burdens RBL's exercise of his right to counsel. He expresses confusion again about his right to counsel. He says he doesn't want to go to a lawyer. He does not like the problem, which again is indicative that he doesn't understand really what's happening. He's not communicating effectively. And the detectives say, I don't think you have anything to hide, kind of bringing back something that RBL had said at the outset before he knew his rights, before he even could have known what was happening. They tell him, I don't think you have anything to hide. And in so doing, they severely undercut telling him he has a right to counsel. Because if now he says he feels that he is in over his head, if he tries to exercise his right to counsel, he'll essentially be admitting he does have things to hide, and he'll be implicitly admitting guilt. And so they've put him in this situation where he has not been told what his rights are. He doesn't understand what it means to have a right to an attorney, because he thinks that if he asks for a lawyer, he'll be admitting guilt. And that is a factor that, in addition to all of the other factors, weighs heavily against the finding of a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver in this case.
What relevance, if any, does the defendant's inflection, tone, mannerisms have to the Miranda inquiry? The trial court found that he seemed animated, emphatic, comfortable, and on the video, it does seem like that was the case. He doesn't look like he is being coerced. How is that relevant?
It's relevant for the trial court to consider. However, it's important to consider what RBL or a person in RBL's situation would have understood. He thinks he's there to talk about a minor civil dispute. He thinks that if he stands on his rights, if he invokes his rights, he's going to be seen as guilty. He's trying to be helpful, because that's how the police have framed this entire interrogation.
But what about his manner once they're asking questions about touching Odell?
So under those circumstances, that doesn't, first, validate what otherwise was an invalid waiver. RBL didn't understand his rights in the first instance, and substantive questioning after the fact can't solve the fact that he didn't know what he was giving up, he didn't understand his rights. Insofar as the only circumstance had been, we want to talk to you about tools, and then they start talking about allegations of criminal sexual contact, even if that's not all there is, but even if it were, RBL had no way of knowing that they'd suddenly transitioned to this topic that was very, very serious, that was putting him in great jeopardy, because everything, the lie about the tools was very clever. The tools were in dispute because RBL had gotten kicked out of the house. He was kicked out of the house because his stepdaughter told her mother that RBL had abused her, and the stepdaughter told the mother because RBL came home that night, found the boyfriend in her room, and got upset. And the detectives get to that, transition to that, by saying, let's talk about the backstory here. And so a reasonable person in RBL's position would think that what the stepdaughter said is relevant to the inquiry of who owns these tools. And again,
don't they specifically ask him questions about touching Odell before he says anything inculpatory?
Yes, but those questions are framed in terms of the backstory to why he's at the police station to talk about tools.
Did they mention the word tools?
They never mention the word tools, but they say, let's get to the backstory here. As you know, we talked to her. But the tools are in dispute because his ex-wife kicked him out of the house.
You've characterized the reference to tools as a lie. We know a lie is a deliberate falsehood. And so the prosecutor and the AG, that analysis would then require us to get into the head of the police officers who are doing the questioning. Now, in this case, there's the acknowledgement that they told him they were going to ask about tools, and there's no reference whatsoever during the actual interrogation of tools, which could provide a circumstantial basis to think that they were deliberately trying to perceive somebody. But what about other cases where, if they, for example, talked about tools for a little while, could we then, under our tradition of not getting into analysis that hinges on the subjective state of mind of police officers, how could we determine if something fits your definition of a lie?
So it's still a factor to consider in the totality of the circumstances. If they truthfully talked about, and that essentially then we're in the facts of Nyhammer. In Nyhammer, they said, come down to the station, we want to talk to you about allegations that your uncle abused the victim. Trenna says, sure. Mirandize him, he gives a statement as to that. They then transition to talking about allegations that the victim made against the defendant. And that is a lie by omission. The detectives didn't tell him that's what they were going to do when he came there.
But there is a nexus here. And this is where it becomes very difficult to state a principled rule that might not affect cases inappropriately. And that is that none of us are in the detective's heads here on this, but it may be that the strategy was, let's get him going on the tools. He's gotten kicked out. And we can ask him why he was kicked out, and then we may open the door to getting some information about this sexual contact with the child. So they skipped right to perhaps what was intended to be question number 5, which is, let's talk about the backstory as to why you were kicked out. They skipped over this issue with the tools, obviously. But there was a substantive connection here between this issue of him getting kicked out, presumably, causing the tool issue to come up, and these allegations.
So a couple of answers, and then I would like to get back to the key distinction between Nyhammer. But you can't have a strategy. You can't have a tactic when you're reading a defendant his Miranda rights. Miranda rights are critically important. Police must do it appropriately. They're not a pre-interview. They're not an opportunity to frame the discussion to lead to later criminal admissions. The defendant's constitutional rights, he must be read them, he must understand them, he must provide a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver.
But just to be clear, they were read to him.
They were read, but he didn't understand them on this record.
And they were read to him in the context of him thinking that he was there talking about something relatively minor that had nothing to do with what the actual criminal investigation was about. So from the defendant's perspective, he did not have a full understanding of why he was there and why he was going to be questioned prior to waiving his rights.
Yes, because of this misstatement by police. To return briefly to why this is distinguishable from Nyhammer, Nyhammer was asking for a bright line rule. If you fail to announce he's a suspect, that's it, suppress. This court rejected that. It maintained that suspect status and the defendant's knowledge of it is relevant. And critically, in Nyhammer, the defendant testified, I understood my rights. And not only that, I understood that when they changed tack, when they started accusing me of things, I understood I didn't have to answer those questions. And so under those circumstances, in Nyhammer, the misstatement, the omission of information under the totality of the circumstances did not change the underlying validity of the waiver. The defendant understood his rights, and he knowingly and voluntarily gave up those rights under the totality of the circumstances. And that's why we're seeking, that's why in this case, it's the perfect example of why the totality of the circumstances works and why it requires reversal.
But in Nyhammer, his very argument was that because I thought I was there for a different reason, and I was not advised of my suspect status, my waiver was not knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. That was precisely the argument he made, that it invalidated the waiver to have not, to the way the conversation later evolved.
Yes, but in Nyhammer, the defendant said, you didn't tell me about my suspect status under AGD. That's critically important information that I need in order to effectuate a waiver. This court said, no, that's not, that the failure to get this information doesn't automatically invalidate a waiver. It's merely a relevant factor in the totality. And in the totality in Nyhammer, particularly where the defendant himself says, I understood I didn't have to speak, I understood that I could not answer questions implicating myself, and he spoke anyway, those circumstances demonstrate that the waiver was valid. It did operate effectively, notwithstanding the fact that the police left out this bit of information.
So what is it that they had to tell him? Could they have said nothing? We want you to come to the police station?
Yes, they could say nothing. They could say, RBL, we'd like you to come down to the police station and talk to you. They could tell him truthfully why they were there. We'd like you to, your stepdaughter has made allegations that you inappropriately touched her, and we want to talk to you about those. They could do either of those things, but what they should not have done is lie. They should not have said, we want to talk to you about tools, when they had no intention of talking to him about tools. They should not have intentionally hid the true nature of this investigation, the true jeopardy that RBL was in, because that undercuts the Miranda warnings.
But so if the detective specifically told the defendant that his decision to waive was not final and that he could withdraw the waiver at any point, at any time, he could cease questioning, he could consult with an attorney at any point, then why does it matter that they only started asking him about inappropriately touching Odell after he waived his rights and rather than before? Why could at that point he not have said, I would like to cease questioning, or I would like to consult with an attorney?
Because they told him that if you have nothing to hide, you don't need a lawyer. He had no way to exercise that right without admitting guilt under the framework the detectives provided.
They told him that if you have nothing to hide, I don't think they quite put it that way.
That's
an argument more than a...
They said, you have a right to a counsel. He says, I don't want to go to a lawyer. I don't like the problem. They respond with, Detective Rodriguez says, I don't think you have anything to hide. Detective Tiernan says, right. And then RBL responds, exactly. So he's taking their, I don't think
no,
you have
no,
anything.
I know how it played out. I just thought that it was perhaps...
Yes, Your Honor is correct. They don't, with their words, say, if you invoke your right to counsel, we will infer guilt. They don't say that, but they imply it. And this court has held in LH, in ODAC, that following a valid waiver, in the interrogation itself, you can't do this kind of undermining of the Miranda warnings. And those cases were in situations where the defendant had been appropriately read his warnings, at least in LH. They'd been appropriately read the warnings. He said he understood. He waived them. And then in the interrogation itself, the detectives start undercutting those rights. Here what we have is even worse, because they're undercutting the rights before they've even read them. They're undercutting the rights before RBL has understood them, before he's said, I understand I can talk to a lawyer. I understand you won't infer guilt from me talking to a lawyer. And I want to talk to you anyway without a lawyer present. And that is particularly damaging in this case and weighs very heavily against a finding of a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver of his rights.
Do you have any thoughts about Justice Albin's concurring opinion in Gonzalez, which one of the amici on your side says we should take note of?
I think that lies by police officers, affirmative misstatements, are always relevant and ought to be avoided. And in substantive interrogations, I think this court has recognized in LH, in ODAC, that these substantive lies, minimization, false ploys about evidence can affect the voluntariness of a confession. I think that's, this court's case law has established that and can be reaffirmed. But it's particularly insidious, and it's particularly insidious when these same tactics occur in the waiver itself.
Just to be clear, as you mentioned to the chief in response to his question, you're not asking for a bright line rule of any kind.
No, I'm asking that under the totality of these circumstances, RBL did not provide a valid waiver of his
because
rights.
This is not the case that Justice Albin was forecasting? It's not strong enough?
I think this case is quite strong. I think there's a lot here. I think this lie is particularly egregious. I think changing the very nature, criminal versus civil, of what they want to talk about is particularly bad. I think the fact that it happened pre-waiver as opposed to post-waiver is particularly bad. I think the U.S. Supreme Court has left open the question as to whether this is even permissible under federal law. In Colorado v. Spring v. Colorado, they dropped that footnote that says some lies can invalidate Miranda. We're not deciding whether affirmative misstatements about the defendant's status or the scope of the interrogation are permissible. They leave open that question. And I think given this court's continued or long history of providing greater protections to defendants in New Jersey, I think this could be the case to do that. I don't think for RBL we have to go that far. I think this waiver under the existing case law, under the totality of the circumstances, is bad.
Are there more questions on this issue? Anyone?
I just had one question about when he came back in. So he agrees to come in for additional questioning 11 days after his first interview, and he schedules that second interview 7 days in advance, correct? He says he's not available on the 21st,
yes,
and he can only come on the 28th, I think. So what would be the justification for suppressing the second statement, as at that point, of course, he knew the nature of the investigation because he had spoken for, I think, 80 minutes about it?
Because it's tainted by the inadmissible first interrogation. The detectives begin that interrogation by specifically saying, we read you these rights before. So they incorporate by reference all of the problems with the initial Miranda colloquy. They incorporate that by reference.
I thought he tried to say, no, you don't have to read it again, and then they insist on reading it again anyway.
I could be mistaken. I believe that it was the detective who did it, but either way, the second interrogation is simply a continuation of the first one, because with respect to the Miranda colloquy, they don't go back and clarify exactly what they're talking about. They don't clarify the fact that they'd previously undercut his right to counsel. So RBL has no way of knowing that what they told him the first time is in fact not true.
But he now knows what the subject matter is.
You can't
possibly read those two transcripts and think that by round two he was in any way confused as to what he's being asked about.
No, however, again, if the first statement is suppressed, the second statement must be suppressed because it's unduly tainted by the first one. They begin with this recap of the Miranda rights, referencing the first colloquy. They then begin by, under the guise of getting the other detective up to speed, do a quick run through of all of the most damning admissions from the first statement. And so if the first statement is suppressed, the second statement must be suppressed as well. They're impossible to untangle. All of the problems from the first one carry over to the second statement. But even if this court finds that only, if the court finds that either one of these statements must be suppressed, either one would require reversal of RBL's convictions. The jury asked for playback of these statements. The jury verdict indicates that we're relying on RBL's admissions during these statements as opposed to the complainant's trial testimony given their acquittal of the third degree criminal sexual contact.
Do you want to do 2 minutes on Hampton?
Yes,
only
please.
2 minutes, please.
I will keep it brief, I promise. As the U.S. Supreme Court recognized in Crane v. Kentucky, regardless of whether the defendant marshaled the same evidence earlier in a motion to suppress, and entirely independent from the question of voluntariness, a defendant's case may rise or fall on his ability to convince the jury that the manner in which the confession was obtained cast doubt on its credibility, because in any case where a defendant's statement is admitted, the jury has to be able, for the defense to win, the jury has to be able to the jury needs this question answered. If the defendant is innocent, why did he previously admit his guilt? And in New Jersey, in recognition of this critical role that juries play in assessing the voluntariness and therefore truthfulness of statements, this court in Hampton held that jurors must be specifically instructed that it's their job to evaluate all of the circumstances of a defendant's confession, including factors that play on voluntariness, factors relating to the Miranda rights, as well as the other factors about the statement's underlying truth. And then in light of all those circumstances, the jury must decide what weight, if any, to give to the defendant's statement. And in this case, those two key parts of the Hampton instruction were missing. The court did not give the full Hampton charge. The court failed to identify the factors affecting the voluntariness of the statement, the validity of the Miranda rights, what RBL understood about his Miranda rights, and the ways in which things like the language barrier affected what value to give to things RBL said during his statement. And without this legal framework, the jury didn't have the tools necessary to evaluate a key component of RBL's defense. During defense counsel's summation, he points to all of these specific things. He points to the lie about the tools. He points to the language barrier. He points to the fact that the detectives didn't ask RBL how far in school he went, if he could read. He points to the fact that RBL gave nonsensical answers to some of the questions. And arguments are nice, but they're not the law and they're not evidence. The trial court provides the legal framework for what the jury should do with the facts that they heard, and the judge didn't do that here. The judge didn't provide the necessary legal framework, and that omission was clearly capable of producing an unjust result in this case where the defendant's statements were so critical.
Thank you, Ms. McLean.
Thank you.
Mr. Yenikak.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Over the past 20 years, this court has been asked to define the contours of the fundamental right against self-incrimination and the corollary Miranda rights that go along with it. In 2003, in AGD, this court found that where an arrest warrant or complaint has been issued outlining the suspects or defendants, future defendants, charges, it must be they must be informed of that fact. And without that, there can't be a knowing, voluntary, and knowledgeable waiver of those rights. Then six or so years later in Nyhammer, the court was asked whether a police officer must inform a suspect or future defendant, potential future defendant, of suspect status. And this court answered in the negative. And that is because in AGD, where there's an arrest warrant or complaint warrant issued, the charges outlined in there are objectively verifiable. There are charges there. And they did not, and this court did not want to impose an, albeit an unduly burdensome, a burden upon police officers to have to articulate their subjective minds. And then in 2019 in Vincenti, this court again reaffirmed AGD and explained that police officers, where a complaint warrant, arrest warrant is issued, must give a concise declaratory statement outlining those charges in an arrest warrant or complaint warrant. And then in Sims, in 2022, this court was asked whether a police officer who arrests a suspect has the affirmative obligation to advise that defendant of the reasons for that arrest. And this court answered in the negative, rightly so.
Now, counsel, could you tell us the black letter law that you're advocating today?
Yes. Those four cases dealt with affirmative obligations of police officers. What I am advocating for today is that there should be a bright line rule where police officers are not permitted to make affirmative misrepresentations about the seriousness of the offense, the circumstances of the potential offense, and the reasons for those questioning. Now, that's different from the holding in Sims, different from the holding in Nyhammer, which dealt with affirmative obligations on police officers. And that was because, it would become a burden upon those police officers. How does one police officer from another police officer determine what charges may come in the future? In this case, a police officer has made an affirmative misrepresentation. Could have stayed silent, but he made an affirmative misrepresentation that defendant's ex-wife was disputing ownership of tools and that they wanted to speak to him back at the police station.
So suppose in this case, mm-hmm. there were one additional fact
okay.
that after the statement that you've labeled as misleading, the defendant said to the officer, I know why you're here. I know you want to talk about my stepdaughter. And everything else is the same. No response by the police, and then you have the statements that flow from that. Must those statements be suppressed under the bright line rule that you've advocated today?
No, Your Honor. It would not.
How is that? I thought you had a
better
rule.
No, that is because the affirmative misrepresentation, as Justice Albin had outlined in this concurring opinion in Gonzales, effectively usurps or misleads an individual into giving up their, it imposes upon their will. Now they're in a situation, at least in this case, in RBL, where he's going back to the police station, he believes he's going to be questioned about a civil matter, the tools, and then he gets presented with these allegations. In a case where, with the fact you presented, if RBL in this case knew that he was going to be questioned about the allegations made by his former stepdaughter, then the effect of the affirmative misrepresentation is not the same. He knows.
So what is your rule? Because as I heard you articulate it initially, it mm-hmm. was affirmative misrepresentations about the reasons for questioning render the statement inadmissible, suppressed. Here you have those misrepresentations, but yet not a problem because?
I think it's a little... It's respectfully a little more nuanced than that, because you have to look at the misrepresentation and see what effect it has on a defendant. If a defendant...
The totality of it.
Yes, I think you heard the same question three times. Go ahead, Justice.
So the totality of the circumstances surrounding that misrepresentation.
It may be just that one specific misrepresentation, but not the other totality circumstances factors that come into play maybe when we're doing the standard totality of circumstances.
So you don't have a bright line rule. You're saying that if the court reads into the defendant's statements or conduct a state of mind, you don't have a bright line rule.
Well, if it's
or at least it's kind of a dim line rule, perhaps, but that it has some exceptions to it.
Maybe it's if there is an objectively verifiable misrepresentation. In this case, we want to talk to you about the tools, and the defendant. Believes it. The fact you presented, there is an additional fact. There's additional testimony there where the defendant admits, I knew what they were. I didn't believe them. They weren't lying to me. I know.
But isn't that the problem with the bright line rule? And I understand the attraction from the defendant's perspective of a bright line rule, because it will loop in with it situations in which there are nuanced aspects to the case that nullify the concern. That is being expressed in the bright line rule. I mean, aren't we better off with looking at these things holistically and considering all the facts?
In certain circumstances, yes. And what I would posit is that there are definitely circumstances where the bright line rule will apply appropriately. And this is one of the cases where it would apply. In other cases in which...
The court, I'm sorry, would have to ask if the defendant subjectively believed it, or if the misstatement was such that an objective or reasonable defendant would have believed it. Is it objective or subjective on the you said that there is a piece that depends on the defendant's part. Mm-hmm. Is it only whether he believed it, or is it with whether a reasonable person in his position would have believed it?
I would say if he specifically had believed it. How I would envision it is
that... How do you find that out?
Well, it would be...
He may choose to offer that, but...
Mm-hmm. Well, it is the state's burden to show beyond the reasonable doubt that the defendant knowingly, intelligently, voluntarily waived.
So how does the state have to present evidence to show what the defendant must have known in some other fashion?
No, I think that...
It gets a little cloudy.
In the situation you posited, there was, I would imagine it was in the transcript.
Move beyond the hypothetical. Okay. There are going to be areas where it's quite murky, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure how this black letter rule that is being suggested would apply. Mm-hmm. Can you help us?
Yes. So I do think that in very narrow situations where it's clear that it is, that the police officer made a bold-faced lie, like in this situation where the bright line rule would apply. In other situations, maybe in the majority of these cases, that there are other indicia that would be applicable. And in those circumstances, the affirmative misrepresentation, rather than be a factor among other factors, should weigh more heavily than those other factors in those cases. So in a case where it's not as clear that there is a pure affirmative, for example, let's say an individual gets arrested because of traffic tickets. We want to talk to you about, there's an outstanding warrant. We want to talk to you about those traffic tickets. Lo and behold, they actually want to talk to the defendant about some, let's say, tax evasion. And he has no idea that that's happening. In that situation, it wasn't a purely affirmative misrepresentation that they were arresting him for that traffic ticket, and that potentially those are charges or those are
some
culpability.
Well, if it's an arrest, the game is totally different. The analysis is totally different. Once there's an arrest, you're in Vincenti and mm-hmm. AGD.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about here only suspect status.
Okay, so then I can go to Diaz. And Diaz, So in this circumstance, the defendant was being questioned about narcotics. The police officers did not inform him that there was a death because of his narcotics. They didn't inform him of that fact. So they questioned about narcotics, trying to get him to admit he had other narcotics, potentially execute a search warrant, find the narcotics that matched the same narcotics that resulted in the death of the individual. In that case, the appellate division applied a totality of the circumstances test, but added more weight to the affirmative misrepresentation there. So in those circumstances where there is some truth, where there isn't a pure affirmative misrepresentation, I'm talking about the bright line rule should apply in situations where it's egregious. In this case, we want you to come talk to us about a civil matter.
Could the bright line rule be easily avoided, perhaps, by just tacking on something like, and some other things? Because then the defendant would have the opportunity to say, well, what other things, seeking to clarify it. So would that bright line rule not really work well anyway, because it could be easily dealt with by saying, and other things?
I don't think so. And in this case, there's some ambiguity whether the police officer said, I want to talk to you about the civil matter and some other things, or the ownership of the tool and other things. In that circumstance, the affirmative misrepresentation was egregious. It was, we're not going to ask you questions, potentially ask you questions about a non-criminal matter. Come back, let's talk. Based on that misrepresentation, the individual RBL here waived his Miranda rights. And then they started asking questions about a criminal matter. I think
they asked about the tools. One question while they had them in there, would that then eliminate the inference of a lie, because they did ask about the tools?
There's nothing in the record that there was even a dispute of ownership of the tools. The complainant's mother had gone the day before to the police officers, to the detectives, informed them about these allegations. The police officers asked her, when is the next time you're going to see him? Said, oh, he's coming by tomorrow to pick up his tools. So the police officers came with no intention of even asking about the tools or even investigating this dispute of the ownership of the tools. As a false pretense came, they saw him, they said, during the Miranda hearing, what did you do upon defendant's arrival? Detective Tiernan and I introduced ourselves and related that complainant's mother was disputing his ownership of the tools that he had come to retrieve, so we asked he would come back to Jackson Township Police Department for an interview. There was no dispute of ownership of the tools. That in the bright line rule would work in this case. It was
counsel, since we're looking to decide and provide a construct for cases into the future, of course, as well. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with the framework that the public defender has suggested? Where you have an affirmative misrepresentation of sorts, that should weigh heavily against a finding of a knowing and a voluntary waiver. Totality of the circumstances test, not an effort at a bright line rule that may or may not stand firm. What's wrong with that approach?
There's nothing wrong with that approach. As I outlined in our brief, ideally, there would be some circumstances in which a bright line rule would apply, but at the minimum, there should be a test articulated giving guidance to trial courts, giving guidance to the appellate division, that affirmative misrepresentations, if they exist, should be a material factor or a factor more heavily weighed than potentially other factors in the totality of the circumstances test when determining whether there was a valid Miranda waiver.
The language from ODAC, weigh heavily against the finding.
Yes. But there are...
Our current law really does all that.
It failed in this circumstance. There was a clear affirmative, at least an ambiguous. I would say it's clear, but there is some... counsel argues there is an ambiguity, but there are circumstances.
In terms of the standard that, and I understand your argument on the facts, and you made it very articulately, but the standard that currently exists with this playing a role in the totality of the circumstances test and weighing heavily, why is it necessary to change the inquiry, to change the standard?
I think it goes back to why Miranda was put into place. There's inalienable rights against self-incrimination. There's Miranda rights. Miranda rights are non-negotiable. It's not a situation where once Miranda rights are read during an interrogation, police officers can, exaggerate or lie about the strength of the evidence, et cetera. It's a non-negotiable right.
Police officers cannot exaggerate the strength of the evidence?
No, I said they can.
They can.
They can. But that's not an issue being presented here.
You're saying they can do that post-Miranda.
Yes. Yes. And I think that this court has decided that several times. And obviously there are exceptions. You can't downplay the rights during it. You can't say this is confidential. No one's going to know about this, which cuts against the purpose of the Miranda rights. But there are circumstances in which there is such egregious facts where one cannot help but find objectively that there is not a valid waiver.
If they're so egregious, you're going to win.
Mm-hmm. And then
how do you define egregious in the context of individual cases?
Well, in this case, it's non-criminal versus criminal. I think that I understand it's very narrow because how often is it going to come up how often is it going to come up in a situation where police officers are essentially saying, we want to talk to you about a non-criminal matter, come back. The police officer proceeds to read the Miranda rights and then proceeds to talk to him about or her about a criminal matter.
Well, it wasn't exclusive. I mean, granted, it was a quick statement, but there were other things mentioned.
Other things.
Is it relevant here that the detective started asking about defendant's touching of Odell before defendant said anything inculpatory, whereas in Diaz, the police try to keep up the lie until after the defendant has already made the inculpatory statements, and then they say, oh, and this person died?
It does not. I think it was Vincenti that clarified it, that in the situation where there is a complaint warrant, police officers have the affirmative obligation to advise the defendant of that fact and the charges contained in there. Could be after or before the Miranda warning, but before the interrogation.
But here there was no complaint warrant.
Exactly. So I think that the same reasoning should apply before an interrogation happens, either clarify the affirmative misrepresentation. I think once the interrogation starts and the affirmative misrepresentation has been made and is in effect, it should have no effect that the first question coming afterwards is about the allegations. The initial conversation between police officers and RBL happened in a driveway. If in the driveway the police officer says, we want to talk to you about these sexual allegations, maybe RBL decides, I'm not going to go to the police station to talk to the police officers. Now that he's there and they start asking him questions, is he really comfortable leaving and stopping his questioning? He wasn't born here. He's born in Argentina. Seems to be some language barriers. He might not understand the implications of the Miranda rights or the fact that he might be able to invoke his rights again. I know in Tillery add an additional factor where you can say you can invoke these rights at any time. But
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think we're a little bit beyond the 5 minutes at this point. Is there anything else you'd like to add to your argument?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Carroll, and I'd invite you to adopt arguments that have already been advanced that you agree completely with. Please go ahead.
May it please the court. The ACLU is here as a friend of the court to offer our assistance in resolving a dispute about the viability of RBL's purported waiver of his right against self-incrimination. This court has already recognized that a police officer cannot contradict out of one side of his mouth the Miranda warnings that are given out of the other side. Under that simple standard, we propose that the court adopt the bright line rule, which is limited in our papers, so that it's consistent with this court's existing jurisprudence, including—
Why don't you articulate it for us now? Go ahead.
Sure, Your Honor. Sure, Chief. Our rule would say that law enforcement cannot affirmatively mislead a suspect about the seriousness of an investigation by characterizing that investigation as a civil matter when, in fact, they also want to discuss a criminal investigation.
Did they ever ask him, did they ever say to him, we're here on a civil matter? I mean, everybody's referring to the civil matter language that was not offered by the detective and what he said to them. He said, I told him we're going to talk to him about this issue with the tools. But if what we're talking about here, if this seems to be just taking on as if he said we are here only on a civil matter, RBL, and that just didn't happen, did it?
Your Honor, our rule applies where there are pre-waiver statements that are about the civil nature of the investigation without the proper context, and in that situation, the defendant is affirmatively misled about the nature of the investigation. And there are situations.
Page 203 of the transcript. Maybe this is what is relevant. Question: it became a civil matter at that point, and that's what you basically told him. Basically told him. Correct. Answer: correct. That's what you're relying on your point.
Yes, Your Honor. And also to illustrate, there will still be situations where our rule doesn't apply because it's a limited rule. And there will be situations where this court's traditional totality of the circumstances analysis still applies, such as Nyhammer and Sims.
So I want to see how porous the bright line rule is, if you will. The hypothetical that was tossed out earlier, if the defendant here had said, I know why you're here and it's about the stepdaughter, you have an affirmative misrepresentation that seems to run afoul of the bright line rule. Suppression?
No, Your Honor. Because in that situation, there was initially, by law enforcement, there was the creation of the false impression that it was simply about a civil matter or a civil dispute, but there the defendant is aware of the nature of the investigation, and that changes the situation where our rule is limited to the confines of a situation like RBL situation, where he does not know until after the waiver that he is also going to be questioned about a criminal matter.
So respectfully, it doesn't sound like a bright line rule. It sounds like a rule that has exceptions, which is more akin to the totality of the circumstances rule that the court has been applying. Am I mistaken about that?
Well, Your Honor, there are situations where it still would be the totality of circumstances, like Nyhammer and Sims.
I'm talking about this fact pattern.
Correct.
Where we now somehow probe into what was in the defendant's mind, which may not always be easy to figure out.
I agree, Your Honor. But this is, our rule is limited to the situation where there are not those additional statements, and simply you just left with the situation that law enforcement provides information about the civil nature of the interrogation without the proper context. And we believe that it's important to know cases where totality still applies, like in Nyhammer, where there was, to paraphrase, a salient observation that in many, if not most situations, a person being questioned know that they're being questioned about a criminal matter. In Nyhammer, yes, there were some omissions. He thought that he was talking about his uncle's involvement in an alleged sexual crime, and he didn't know that he was also a target initially. And also in Sims, where the defendant was placed in handcuffs and was under arrest. So initially he knew that he was within the criminal justice system. Our rule comes into place where there's the situation where the person does not know that they are within the criminal justice system because of the affirmative misrepresentations by law enforcement.
So at the Miranda hearing, would it be appropriate in that scenario for the state to attempt to introduce proof that the defendant must have known, and here's why? Would that be relevant somehow?
I believe that the state would be permitted to try to introduce that information, but it wouldn't adjust our analysis. Our analysis focused on those pre-warning statements, especially when it's just confined to a civil nature of the investigation without the proper context, Your Honor.
So what if the detectives had said at some point, okay, now the questioning on the civil matter is finished, and now we would like to question you on a criminal matter, and then started asking questions about inappropriately touching Odell? Would that matter?
I think it would be inappropriate if the questioning leading up to the waiver just focused on the civil nature of the investigation, and then after the waiver is secured,
but there's no question. I'm saying, let's say there's no questioning before the waiver, because here the waiver happens right at the beginning. There's no questioning at all before the waiver. So it's waiver, then civil questioning, then they explicitly say, now we would like to question you on a criminal matter, and then start asking about inappropriate touching.
I think our rule comes into play in a situation where there was the initial misrepresentation to get him to the station. Now, the law enforcement, they have additional options. They can tell the suspect the nature of the potential charges, and he can still get a waiver. For example, in AGD, when they went to his house, that waiver was tossed for different reasons because they didn't tell him about the complaint and arrest warrant, but they told him when they went to his residence that they were there to talk about sexual abuse charges. And so they can still do that. Or they can also say, we want you to come down to the station, and without more. And then RBL could have said, well, what do you want to talk to me about? And the police officer could say, we'll get into the details at the station. That does not run afoul of our rule, because there they're not creating the impression that they want to talk about a civil dispute. And then once he gets there, he gives the waiver, they pull the rug from under him.
Questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
No, but we thank the court for considering our brief and allowing us to participate in our argument.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Megan.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'd like to start off by saying this matter, this argument that are, all these arguments that are made today were not raised at the trial level. And the reason that they weren't raised specifically as to any type of misrepresentation is because there was no misrepresentation. The officers here never lied to this defendant. They went there because he was coming there to pick up some tools, and the victim's mother was contending his ownership of those tools. And that's actually what they said to him, because they asked him, to read the whole thing in context, it's been taken out of context, but you see, did you tell him what you were going to talk about? And he said, no, I didn't get into it then. Then he said, but did you ask him about the items he was trying to get back?
I'm sorry, what are you reading from?
I'm reading from page 203. It's actually, I started at page 202, line 24. Well, actually, we could start before that, because that's where he said, I stated I was there to get him to come back to the police station and talk to him about a few things that had gone on. And he said, did you tell him what you were going to talk about? And he said, no, I didn't get back into it back then. So did you talk to him about the items he was trying to get back? And he said, briefly, yes. The victim's mother had related that she was disputing his ownership of those, so it essentially became a civil matter at that point. And then that's the point that they keep reading over and over again. I'm not going to repeat it again. But then the next line, but you told him you were going to take him down to headquarters to talk about something, correct? Correct. But you didn't tell him what? No, I didn't. He had no idea what? You don't know? I don't know what his thought process was at that point.
Would a reasonable person, based on what we know from the record at the Miranda hearing and at the trial, would a reasonable person have come away believing the officers were going to question about possession of tools?
It's a state position, no, because I think that everyone here, and I don't mean any disrespect, I'm not trying to call defense counsel unreasonable, but the what I'm trying to say is that what we're looking at here is this was basically a non-issue. What defense counsel, I think, was trying to get into was whether they questioned them first, warn later type thing.
I don't know that it's a non-issue, and I want to read three passages for you and then come back to the very same question.
Okay.
What a reasonable person would know. The first is from the Miranda hearing. Detective Tiernan and I introduced, and this is page 13, introduced ourselves and related that the ex was disputing his ownership of the tools that he had come to retrieve. So we asked if we could, if he would come back to the police station for an interview. This is from trial. Page 197. We addressed the issue of the property he was looking to take possession of. And there were some tools, correct? Yes, sir. And you told him he couldn't get his tools. Answer, basically. And again, from the Miranda hearing, and this has been read before, it became a civil matter at that point, and that's what you basically told him, correct? Answer, correct. Would a reasonable person have concluded from these statements that the officer admitted to that the defendant was about to be questioned about possession of tools?
Two things to answer that question. First, again, it was not a lie. Everybody keeps talking about how this is a lie.
Stay with my question.
And I am. I just wanted to make that clear first. Secondly, you have to take big steps there. You have to take you have to make assumptions on what the defendant is thinking at that point, because the
Be clear about my question, I'm looking for a reasonably objective standard to measure what this defendant was told. Is it reasonable for an individual under those circumstances to believe the person is about to be questioned about possession of tools?
Well, again, you need to look at everything here. And I'm going to say no, because that same colloquy, when you get down to 204, this is also quoted in my brief, that they said, our function there was also, what conversation did you have with him? That conversation was pertaining to the property that he was looking to retrieve. And you know, our function there was also served a purpose of keeping the peace. Obviously, the defendant left the house under less than ideal circumstances too. So to prevent a further issue of us being there, you know, is not a bad thing. In other words, yes, they told him when they were there that they're discussing, because he was going there to pick up these tools. And yes, and based on the trial testimony, which, by the way, I'm pretty sure we're not supposed to pay attention to in a Miranda hearing, but nevertheless, even based on that, you had the officers going there. Yes, they're saying you can't get the tools. This is essentially a civil matter. But that's not why they asked him to come to the station, and that's what's important. They told him to come down because they wanted to talk about something else. They wanted to talk about other matters. And that's supported by the record, and also important for this court's review, we have the law division judge finding that they told him that they're going down to talk about other matters.
But doesn't the detective say, detective, and the chief read this, Detective Hernan and I introduced ourselves and related that complainant's mother was disputing his ownership of the tools that he had come to retrieve, period. So we asked him if he would come back to the Jackson Township Police Department for an interview. Doesn't the word so imply that they asked him?
Because of that. Yeah, I can understand that in a vacuum. But again, we have to look at all the facts that were presented. This is all from the same Miranda hearing. These are the facts that were presented to the judge. So he clarified that. Albeit during the defense's cross-examination, but nevertheless, he clarified exactly what was going on here.
So we understand your position that this was not misleading.
It was not misleading, correct.
Let's assume for purposes of certain following questions that it was.
Okay.
Does that taint the knowing and voluntary nature of a waiver? Should the law permit sanction officers to mislead defendants as they are attempting to get them to waive their Miranda rights?
To a degree, yes. I believe that officers can, assuming those facts were correct, which, again, I adamantly say they were not.
You understand.
I want to make that clear.
Not asking for a concession.
Okay, but nevertheless, It's always going to be, and Nyhammer made this clear, that in unique circumstances with non-disclosure, it's going to be a totality of circumstances test. And we actually agree with that. We believe it's always a totality of circumstances. So you have to look at it. And let's take this case on its face. Let's pretend that's what they sold him. Let's say he believed that they were there to talk about a civil matter. As we stated in the beginning, they went through the Miranda rights. They were very adamant about making sure he understood, you know, especially when it came to the language barrier, because the only reference at all that you can make in this entire thing about him having a problem with the English language is when he said sometimes. And the officers repeatedly said, well, if you're having any trouble understanding anything, you know, make sure that you stop us. But my point is that they get right into the reasons why he was kicked out of the house. You know, they talk about his ex-wife, and they're talking about his relationships and all those types of things. They're never talking about tools. So even if...
So I asked you multiple questions, and I shouldn't have. Let me ask you the second one again. Should the law sanction misleading statements by officers as they're attempting to get a Miranda waiver?
There definitely should not be a bright line rule, if that's what you're asking. And the idea is, can they give some... You say in order to get a Miranda waiver. The cases that exist, like ODAC and LH and all these cases that we've decided before, we're not disputing those at all. In fact, those cases, you can't undermine the Miranda warnings. You can't trick somebody into thinking, you know, like we talked about, we're talking out of both sides of your mouth. You can't tell a suspect basically that, you know, this can't be used against you, or that this is nothing, or something of that nature. But of course, those are much stronger cases. And even those, though, still go into a totality of circumstances.
Does it undermine the Miranda warnings if you trick someone into thinking that you're about to question them about a non-serious matter and then interrogate them about a very serious crime?
Well, that would be Nyhammer. Because in Nyhammer, that's exactly what they did. They told him they were questioning him about another person. He didn't think that he was going to be questioned about anything at that point. But yet they gave him his Miranda rights warnings right in the beginning. And that is exactly what Nyhammer was talking about. And in fact, Nyhammer even says that the warnings themselves scream out that you may be a suspect.
Wouldn't law enforcement benefit from clear rules about what's allowed and what's not allowed in terms of training new officers, in terms of the officers who are involved in a particular situation, if the suggestion, and again, not taking a position on whether there was affirmative misleading here, but if the rule were to say that's not allowed to extract permission to interview the person, waive their rights, they know that. Why is that disadvantageous as opposed to a totality rule, which isn't that quite unpredictable for police officers and those who train them to be able to know for sure, can I do this? Can I not do that? The case law we've had about, you know, charges been filed and so on have some very tangible benefits for the police as well, right?
Yes, but that's just it. Those things are exactly, the reason those are tangible is because of that exact reason, is that they are tangible. They're tangible for everyone involved. There's no question as to what's going on here.
Isn't it an important factor that facts change as an investigation gets off the ground?
So every time.
Often these interrogations occur right after a crime is committed or discovered, and what may seem like a tangential relationship between someone and a particular offense can evolve very quickly into a more serious investigation. So if you had a bright line rule that says you can't bring him in saying we think you were a witness to this, we think you might know who this was, when it turns out as time goes by that there's a lot more about this defendant that they knew, that's Nyhammer.
Yes.
And if there were a bright line rule in that case, really would undermine the Nyhammer rule that the defendant does not have to be informed. You are now a suspect because of the very fact that things change quickly in the course of an investigation.
Right, and it would also hinder just law enforcement conducting these investigations. Remember, like in this case, All we had was a statement of a victim at this point. And you had the suspect here was literally just that, a suspect. They were basically trying to get to the substance of what the allegations were against him. He wasn't under arrest or anything of that matter. It's interesting because counsel at trial conceded that he wasn't in custody, but then said that Miranda was necessary anyway. Now, the court made no finding on that issue, and we're not getting into necessarily a custody issue, but that, again, goes into that totality of circumstances analysis.
Would you agree with the proposition that if an officer does affirmatively mislead a suspect in the manner that has been argued in this case, that should weigh heavily under the totality of the circumstances?
Nyhammer's talked about it being just one factor, although that was not an affirmative misleading comment, but I believe it just goes towards all the factors. I don't agree that it necessarily needs to be heavily. It's going to be very fact specific on what exactly was told to the person, what they were going. You know, like if for example, if the officer said, you know, no matter what you say, you can't get in trouble. I mean, that undermines Miranda, and that's what it comes down to. When we're talking about a knowing involuntary waiver, when we're talking about what they know, they need to know that they have a right to remain silent, that they have a right to attorney, that anything can be used against them in a court, and that they can stop the questioning at any time. Those are the things that are very important that they know. And Nyhammer and Sims, and relating to that cited Colorado v. Spring, talks about you don't need to know everything. You don't need to know this whole penalty of facts that, you know, go towards the wisdom of that decision. The question is, do you know that you can stop speaking at any time? In this case, I think it was abundantly clear, and the trial court and the appellate division both found no indication he was lied to, that he understood his rights. And
there was nothing here saying, forget this is just a formality, this is just something
right.
we
they
have
had
to
none
say.
Of that. In fact, these officers were very meticulous with this defendant and trying to make sure. I'm sorry, I may have cut you off if you're. But anyway, they.
But again, I know you're not concede, you don't agree that there was a misrepresentation with regard to the police officers telling him that they wanted to speak to him about the tools. Notwithstanding all the testimony that everyone has gone over numerous times, you don't agree that he was told that he was being asked to go down and talk about the tools. Assuming that he was, or looking at the officer's testimony when they say that they told him that they wanted to talk to him about the tools, at the moment he was making that decision to waive his rights, he did not what he didn't know was that the discussion about the advisement that, you know, anything he says can be used against him in a court of law was talking about in a criminal court of law for serious criminal allegations. Isn't that right? Assuming that, based on what the officer said, they told him they wanted to speak to him about the tools. Right. At the moment he was sitting there and making this waiver decision, he did not know that he was waiving his rights and going to be discussing a serious criminal matter.
Two things. First off, I really have to belabor the point. I apologize. But you say that the officer told him that they were talking about the tools. Again, he told him it was essentially a civil matter. They said they talked to him briefly at the scene about why they were there, right? At no point did they say they were bringing him to the station to talk about that. And I think that's really important because we're taking this logical leap there. But anyway, I just want to say that.
Is it a logical leap in the context of what happened here? They're standing in the driveway. They're talking about the tools. The officers say they want to go talk to him. That's not
about
a reasonable person would be under the assumption that they're going to be talking about this issue where this individual just came over to the house to get these tools. The police are there. They tell him, you can't get these tools. We want to talk to you about the issue with the tools.
They didn't say about the issue of the tools, though. They did not say that.
What did they say they were they wanted him to go down to the station to talk about?
They wanted to talk about something else. And Unfortunately, I saw in a police report, which is not part of the record, though, they actually specifically told him a non-property matter. And I'm putting that before the court, but I do recognize that that is not on the record.
What is it that the record we have tells us about what
they said? The record says that they wanted to talk to him about something else, that they wanted to talk to him about some things that were going on, and then that they specifically did not tell him what they wanted to talk about. And that is Sims. That is Nyhammer. That is all these things. Like, you are allowed to bring somebody in and say, we want to talk to you. We're not going to tell you what. You know, and
you're saying there were two different discussions. One is we're here because this tool issue, whatever.
Which was not a lie. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And secondly, we want to talk to you about something else.
Right.
So you're saying that the representation that should be considered when he is at the station and he is he's Mirandized is we want to talk to you about something else.
Correct. And that is clear from the entirety of the record, because while they were there, they never once mentioned tools. Never. It never came up. That wasn't even a thing. That was the reason they were at the scene. That's why they told them they were at the scene, and it's because that was the reason, well, one of the reasons they were at the scene. It is true that they did want to talk to him, but they didn't lie to him. They never gave him a misrepresentation. At best, they explicitly said they did not tell him what they wanted to talk about.
So they didn't say, we want to talk to you about tools. They didn't say, we want to talk to you about these allegations of sexual contact. Right. But they just said, we want you to go to the station. We have other things to talk about.
Right.
We're here on the property and we're chatting about tools, but we have other things to talk about.
Right. And again, when we're looking at totality of circumstances, we need to look at all of the circumstances. We need to look at all of the things that come and all the things that the court found.
Are you saying then, under a totality of the circumstances, that absolutely no weight should be given to any discussion about tools?
In this case?
In this case.
Right. Because it wasn't there. There wasn't a misrepresentation. Now, to go back to your original question, when you talked about weight of any misrepresentation, if there was a misrepresentation in the case, I don't agree that it should be given heavy weight. I believe you need to look at, did that coerce the defendant? Did that undermine the brand warnings? Did that do that type of thing? Like, AGD and Vincente were very clear because we talked about a defendant being under arrest, but not being told that someone has already found that he's guilty, or at least probable cause that he's committed this crime. So any suspect would be in a position where they don't know that whatever they say is not going to matter because they're already under arrest.
Is it your contention that Q&A that's been the focus of a lot of discussion with both sides
yes.
today, which is the thing about this essentially a civil matter, that was referring to the conversation on the wife's property.
Yes, on the driveway.
In other words, what we are physically here talking to you right now about a civil matter. That's what that was.
That's why they said they were there. Yes, and to keep the peace, I believe, is what
to
they
keep
also
the
had
peace.
In the
okay, and then something. When they pivot to come on down to the station, please. It becomes, we have other things to talk about.
Right, and according to this record here, they even indicated a little bit that was going, because they talked about how he left under less than ideal circumstances. So, I mean, given all the facts that we know what happened here, we know that the defendant was kicked out because of the fact that, the victim here basically told his mother what happened, and then he got kicked out. So, all the implications here, again, when you look at this totality of circumstances, this defendant surely knew what's going on. And just like in Nyhammer, once they started specifically saying, Odell talked to us and she told us there was this inappropriate touching and all this, and then he immediately was like, they said, do you know what we're talking about? And he said, we're talking about the scratch and touch and play. From that point on.
So is it your, and you know this transcript far better than I do, is it your representation that there is no testimony whatsoever in this record that he was told, we want to talk to you at the police station about tools?
Never. Not once. Not a word. I can make that assertion right here. They never once said anything about tools on either one of these
So you're saying that whatever was said about why they were there, there was no affirmative misrepresentation in this case as to why they wanted to talk to him?
Correct.
Other questions, anyone?
No.
Anything you'd like to add, counsel? Do you want to address Hampton briefly?
If you'd like me to.
If you want.
Well, I'll just say what's in my, I don't really want to repeat my brief.
We're happy to have you rest on it.
Okay, I'll rely on the brief then. Thank you.
Mr. Cutanaro.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. As Justice Alban wrote for a unanimous court in Nyhammer, defendant knew that he was a suspect as soon as the police asked him the first question about his involvement in the sexual abuse of the child victim in this case. So too here. When the totality of these circumstances are considered, it's clear that defendant knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived his rights for three reasons. First, by the factual findings of the judge, this comment may have been brief and may have been informative, but it was truthful. There was no misrepresentation on these facts. And while defendant didn't raise this below and didn't flesh out the record with that testimony below, the judge's factual findings still cut sharply against his argument today. Second, and just as in Nyhammer, any temporary confusion dissipated within an hour and a half, at which point defendant was Mirandized and, again like in Nyhammer, he was informed about the victim's allegations of abuse. Finally, the statement is not of a kind that could reasonably overbear anyone's will. No false promises were made, no critical information was withheld, and no one, neither defendant nor police, referenced these tools subsequently in that interview. Now, I'd like to start with...
Can I ask you before you go into that, do you agree with the state that it is significant that there was never a statement, and that's the representation we have here, there was never a statement connecting the conversation about to happen at the police station with the tools?
Yes, Your Honor. This isn't the type of case where police ask the defendant to give an admission and they would assist in a civil dispute. This isn't a type of case where police use those tools as a carrot to induce cooperation. Those tools were never mentioned again at any point in the first interview. Defendant does reference the tools a little bit towards the end of the second interview, but it's very, very brief and very attenuated. It's not as if defendant asked for any help with that. So yes, it's very, very important that police never use those tools. To get to one of Justice Rabner's questions, would a reasonable person believe that he was there for the tools? The answer to that is no. Rather than be questioned on the spot with the tools within eyesight in his car in the driveway, defendant was brought down to the police station, a place with very, very clear connotations, and then read Miranda rights which not only scream suspect status, but, and there's a footnote in Nyhammer to this effect, the Miranda warnings have become embedded in routine police practice to the point where the warnings have become part of our national culture. People know what these rights mean, and when rights are read, people understand them and understand what those mean for that particular context. And that particular context here means we're not here to talk about a civil dispute. We're here to talk about something very, very different.
But the stage before that, I think the focus of a lot of the question for good reason is what happened that from the preliminary to the Miranda warnings, before he gets there, and is it your position, as it seems to be the state's position, that there was sort of an end to the tool part of this discussion and a beginning to, we want to talk to you about other things. I may have the phrasing a little wrong, but something like that, at which point the other things are unidentified, but there's no affirmative misrepresentation as to what they wanted to talk to him about?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's reflected both in the officer's testimony that they want to talk about a few things that had gone on.
A few things, not other things.
Not a few things. The other aspect, that language comes from the judge's factual findings where she writes that police advised that they would like to talk to him regarding that being the property dispute, and other matters. And that's the judge's factual findings regarding that issue.
But she's a little bit off on the language there. It's a few things and not other things.
Functionally, I don't see very much daylight between those two terms. Saying that we want to talk about a few things versus going on, a few things that had gone on versus other matters are functionally identical in this context. But that's the record before this court. That's what this court has to consider. Testimony that they wanted to talk to him about a few things that had gone on, and factual findings that they wanted to talk to him regarding that and other matters. And in either event, that's not a misrepresentation.
Can I ask you, in the Attorney General's role in training officers, whether the totality of circumstances test in this kind of setting provides sufficient guidance to police officers about what can or cannot be done in circumstances like this?
Yes, Your Honor. The totality of the circumstances speaks to exactly this kind of circumstance. The jurisprudence out of this court is very clear. A defendant's waiver can't be induced by misrepresentation, and that's out of Cooper, and I believe reiterated in Nyheimer, though I might be misremembering whether that line specifically was cited. And that gives very, very clear guidance as to what officers can or cannot do.
But in this matter, there is at least a debate about whether what was said about tools or not said about tools or not said about the child. There's a debate about whether it was affirmatively misleading or not. So how's a police officer to know from this case what's permitted?
Well, to push back a little bit on that, Your Honor, first off, it's not even misleading. That's not what we have here. That's not what the testimony is. That's not what the factual finding is. And second, sorry, I lost my thought.
No worries. But you know, I just, as we said earlier, there's some bright line do's and don'ts that arrive out of Vincenti and AJD and so on.
And I also
just... Those are, I presume, rather useful in training officers and officers doing their jobs. So should we have something more predictable than add them all up totality in retrospect and see how everybody feels about whether it was voluntary or not?
No, Your Honor, and conveniently, I just found my thought. This is not the kind of statement that would lead a defendant to waive his or her rights. Again, this isn't the kind of statement where, come talk to us and we'll help you with a civil dispute. This isn't, come talk to us about your tools and let's see what we can do. This isn't the type of statement that would lead a defendant to waive his rights and confess to sexually assaulting his stepdaughter. Those are very, very different.
But when they
statements.
Say, the officer says, well, I basically said to him, we're there to talk about a civil matter. That's not potentially something that the other side could say, well, Judge, that's misleading. And then we end up with a retrospective argument about whether it was or wasn't. How useful is that for operational snap judgments at the scene kind of determinations?
Well, it isn't what was said here, first off. That isn't what these officers told him. And then even if that was what was made, the question would then become, did that induce the defendant's waiver? And under the totality of the circumstances, you have to get into what was said, and you need cross-examination regarding that, which by virtue of the fact that the defendant never raised it, we don't necessarily have all that much of in this case.
Mr. Cotanaro, you're here as a friend of the court.
Yes,
and as
sir,
we
Honor.
Think about broader principles, would you object to a statement by this court telling police officers, don't mislead, don't affirmatively mislead defendants, and if you do, that will weigh heavily against a finding of voluntariness in terms of the Miranda warning?
I would push back on the second part of that it needs to weigh heavily in a consideration. This court has already held that where a misrepresentation induces the waiver, that waiver is invalid. There isn't a heavier weight to be placed than saying in the totality that where the misrepresentation induces the waiver, that waiver is not valid. And heavier weight just isn't necessary because where a misrepresentation doesn't induce the waiver, then the misrepresentation had no effect. And again, that's not the situation we have here. This isn't a misleading statement. This isn't an affirmative misrepresentation at all. So I would also note that this wouldn't necessarily be the court, the case to impose such a rule on.
And this is also a case in which this was never raised before the trial. This exact argument was never raised before the trial court.
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct. And it's also a case that's governed by this court's jurisprudence in Nyhammer. There isn't daylight between this case and Nyhammer. Nyhammer, the defendants asked to come down to talk about somebody else's abuse as a witness. This case, he's asked to come down, even giving the defense full credit on what they maintain the officer said, which is not supported by this record. Even giving them that full credit, he was asked to come down to talk about tools. There isn't daylight between coming down as a witness and coming down to talk about something else. In either event, Justice Albin's language rings true. The defendant still knew that he was a suspect as soon as the police asked him the first question about his involvement in the sexual abuse of the child victim in this case. The second that this defendant was told by the officer that Odell talked with us yesterday, told us that some things have been going on over the past couple years between you and her. I think there was some contact between you guys that probably shouldn't have taken place. You touched her a little bit, you know, maybe you shouldn't have. And I think this kind of crossed over a little bit, and I think you know what I'm talking about. And defendant confirmed that Odell had been talking about the scratch and touch and play. That's 4T60-4-7. And 4T58-6-59-25. And the judge found that defendant clearly understood the significance of this questioning. Defendant knew why he was there. At that juncture, he knew, aside from the fact that there had been no discussion of the tools up to that point.
The defendant says that because he didn't know at the exact time that he waived, it doesn't matter if he did know after that. What is your response there?
A waiver continues throughout. There isn't a magic moment at which point a defendant must knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waive. They need to be read the rights. They need to understand the rights. But a defendant waives with every single answer. And that's functionally what happened in Nyhammer, where a defendant didn't know that they wanted to talk about his abuse at the moment that he was read his rights. But then by the time that substantive questioning began, he did know. And that's another appellate division decision, CODA, which the state cites. You have a very similar fact pattern where a defendant is brought in on traffic warrants and Mirandized, thinking he's talking about traffic warrants. And then before substantive questions really begin, officers begin talking to him about arson and start telling him about an arson investigation.
That's CODA.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if in this case the officers had said there's a dispute about the ownership of the tools, let's go down and talk about that, and everything else follows in the same fashion, would your position be the same?
It would certainly be a very different case, Your Honor. Under the totality of the circumstances, you would still consider the fact that he was Mirandized, the fact that he was brought to the station house, the fact that before substantive questioning began, he was told about the allegations against him, and you'd still consider whether those tools were ever brought up or how those tools were used in an interrogation. So there would be a variety of considerations aside from just talking about the tools.
It will be a weaker case for the state and a stronger case for the defendant.
Depending on the other questions and the other circumstances in the totality, yes. But again, it's a totality of the circumstances test centered on whether a given misrepresentation induced a defendant's waiver. So the full body of facts need to be considered in reaching that conclusion.
Other questions, anyone?
I should have asked this of prior counsel, but was there a dispute over tools?
It's a little bit unclear from this record, especially during the Miranda hearing. So I'm unsure at this point, but even if there hadn't been a dispute as to tools, it wouldn't really matter. Again, that wouldn't be the kind of statement that could induce a defendant's waiver. He was still brought down to the station, still Mirandized, still told about the accusations against him before a single inculpatory statement was made.
Even if there were a dispute, we know the police didn't ask a single question about it, so it's hard to say from this record that it was on their minds, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. McLean.
Thank you, Your Honors. Very briefly, I hope. Any reasonable person having experienced this driveway conversation with the police would think they were at the police station to talk about tools. On direct examination, as the court read on page 40, page 13, Detective Tiernan and I introduced ourselves and related that the ex was disputing his ownership of the tools that he had come to retrieve, so we asked if he would come back to the police station for an interview. Even if that's all there was, that's enough to be an affirmative misrepresentation as to why the police want him to come to the police station, as to why they want to talk to him.
But we don't have anything here, just to be clear, that indicates they ever tied the tools into coming down. We have a little bit of a disparity between the trial court's finding and the actual language of what the officer said, which is a few things, if I
Well, so the trial court said they told him they wanted to talk to him at the station about tools and other matters. And again, relying on that factual finding, the trial court found they told him they wanted to talk to him at the station about tools. And as I explained during my previous presentation, the and other matters doesn't kind of sanitize that affirmative misstatement. They had no intention of talking
to him
about
tools. In terms of the testimony. Because the factual findings, are obviously, we defer, and you're arguing that we shouldn't defer in a lot of ways. This particular one, you're saying we should defer
No, I'm saying on 40, page 13, we told him we were there about the tools, so we asked him if he would come down to the police station.
What the testimony that he, with respect to what they said to him, is it the other, a few things?
No, this, what I'm reading is the detective's testimony. The detective said, Detective Tiernan and I introduced ourselves, related that the ex was disputing his ownership of the tools that he had come to retrieve, so we asked if he would come back to the Jackson Police Station.
We they said related, a few things. That
occurs later. That occurs
what,
on...
What was said there?
There, that's page 40, starting 203, line 4. And when you first approached him, why did you tell him you were there? I stated that I was there to get him to come back to the police station and talk to him about a few things that had gone on. That's the line that the state's relying heavily on to kind of say, no one ever talked to him about tools. No one ever pretended that they wanted to talk to him about tools. But shortly thereafter, we get to this exchange where the detective specifically says, I told him about the tools. He characterizes the tool discussion as a civil matter. He says, basically, that's what I told him, that it was a civil matter at that point. He agrees with that statement. And again, any reasonable person in this situation would have no way of knowing that he's being asked to come to talk about allegations of child sexual assault.
Did you make that argument before the trial court? So not focusing in the Miranda hearing about English, but or any of his other questions and how they were then answered, but did you argue before the trial court that he was affirmatively deceived into coming down to the station?
The actual kind of heart of the legal argument was always and remains the totality of these circumstances demonstrate his waiver was not knowing and voluntary. Defense counsel, on direct, the detective said, he said we were going to talk to him about tools. On cross, defense counsel recognizing that RBL's knowledge of the subject of the interrogation is relevant, asks these follow-up questions about what they had told him, when, what RBL was led to believe, and that's how we get the reference to the civil matter. So defense counsel recognized it was relevant.
But you argue, that an affirmative misrepresentation should be a substantial factor in any totality of the circumstances test. Did you argue that before the trial court, that there was an affirmative representation, there was deception, and therefore that was a substantial factor in the analysis?
No, defense counsel did not argue that affirmative misrepresentations should weigh heavily against waiver. Defense counsel focused on this waiver and its validity, but defense counsel recognized that not knowing why you're being brought to the police station, being told it's about tools, was a relevant factor. So no, the defense counsel didn't ask for a bright line rule, focused on other aspects.
And I'm just following up on Justice Wainer-Apter's comment. Did Was the argument made that there was an affirmative misrepresentation?
No. Again.
And I know you weren't the lawyer.
Yes, Your Honor. But again, it's always, the law is clear that it's always a totality of the circumstances analysis. The trial court knew that it was a totality of the circumstances analysis and had the record to assess the totality. And insofar as there's questions in this record, it's...
Obviously, when judges are confronted with a group of arguments, and there was a lot of focus on the language issues and so forth, and the judge can only rule on arguments that are made before her.
Yes, however, I think it's important to consider the burden of proof in this case, which is it's the state's burden to prove the statement comes in. It's not defense's burden to suppress the statement.
How can the state know that they're supposed to be proving that there was no affirmative misrepresentation if there is no argument about an affirmative misrepresentation made? It seems like one of the things that we're faced with on this record is there's a lot of conflicting testimony at the Miranda hearing as to what the detective said, and perhaps that's because no one was arguing that there was an affirmative misrepresentation, and so they weren't actually trying to figure out on the record whether or not there was one.
That's on the state, not on defense counsel, because it's the state's burden to prove that everything happened correctly, that the police acted appropriately, that the police ensured that RBL knowingly understood his rights and knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently waived those rights.
And it always is their burden, but there are many situations where an issue has not come up before the trial court, and sometimes courts don't consider those issues or consider them under a more difficult standard. So, yes, it's always the state's burden, but the raising of issues in a suppression motion, that one is, at least raising the issue, is the defendant's role, is it not?
Respectfully, in the Miranda context, I don't think it is, but even if it is, and even if we're here, plain error is the standard, but the totality of the circumstances is the law. Defense counsel pointed to any number of reasons why RBL did not understand his rights, why he did not provide a valid waiver. And the trial court's statement that his waiver is okay is incorrect. RBL did not knowingly and voluntarily waive his rights because of the statements about the tools, as well as the language barrier, as well as failing to clarify that his statements would be used against him in a criminal trial, as well as impermissibly burdening his right to counsel when he asked what that right meant.
Ms. McClain, I'm going to be a broken record. Is the rule that you're advocating about having the misrepresentation being a strong or substantial factor, is that sufficiently predictable?
A bright line would be...
I'm not advocating or suggesting a bright line either, but just the way it's formulated, could police officers be trained or understand what they can or cannot do?
I believe that strong guidance from this court that the Miranda colloquy, that's not a time for interrogation tactics. That's not a time when police are allowed to affirmatively misrepresent. That's not a time they can minimize the severity of the offense. The Miranda colloquy isn't a time for trickery. Miranda said so, this court has said so. And the kinds of things that police are allowed to do following a valid waiver cannot occur during the waiver colloquy itself.
But the waiver colloquy here at the station, that's not what you're focused on. You're focused on statements that were made back in the driveway.
Respectfully, I'm focused on both. They tricked him to get to the police station, and at the police station, they don't provide him an interpreter. They don't provide him a Spanish language Miranda form. They tell him, he says, I don't want to go to a lawyer, to which they respond, right, I don't think you have anything to hide, thereby implying that if he stands on his rights, if he exercises his right to counsel, they're going to think he's guilty, and that will be an admission. And where RBL has no experience with the criminal justice system, has no prior convictions, has no experience being interrogated by any detectives, let alone these experienced detectives.
You caught my ear there. Right? They said, right, I don't think you have anything to hide?
So the...
Is the word right in there?
So they say, Detective Tiernan, you don't want... And this is 4T, page 33, lines 10 to 23. Detective Tiernan says, you don't want to go to a lawyer, RBL. No, I don't. I don't like the problem. Detective Tiernan. Right, right. Detective Rodriguez. I don't think you have anything to hide. Detective Tiernan. Right. RBL. Exactly. That's
different
the colloquy.
People saying it was not right. I don't, you have nothing to hide.
So Detective Tiernan is agreeing with Detective Rodriguez. To me, my reading of this is Detective Tiernan is agreeing with Detective Rodriguez that RBL does not have anything to hide. And this matters because they're trying to explain to him that he has a right to ask for a lawyer. And he's saying, oh, but I don't want a lawyer. And they say, you don't have anything to hide. That burdens his right.
Thank you, Mr. Plain.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement. Thank you to all counsel.